I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. This fall, Abraham Lincoln is proving to be a big box office draw thanks to Steven Spielberg's biopic. But of course, his entire biography couldn't make it onto the big screen, including a trip that the young congressman took to Boston. Joining me to talk about a side of President Lincoln we may not have heard of is writer Christopher Klein. He's recently written about President Lincoln for the Boston Globe and the History Channel. Chris Klein, welcome back.
Thanks, Callie. Great to be here.
So how is it that Lincoln came to Boston?
Well, you know, we think of him as the great emancipator, but it might be surprising that he basically came to Boston to try to quell some concerns that people had about the nominee of his party that year, which was one of the largest slaveholders in the country. So he comes to Boston in 1848 to stump for Zachary Taylor, a war hero of the Mexican-American War. Owned a large plantation in Mississippi, owned 100 slaves, and Lincoln's coming to Boston to tell his fellow party members to back the slaveholder.
So why Lincoln? I mean, did Zachary Taylor specifically want him, or were the politicos at the time just interested in this young up-and-coming congressman sort of being on the scene? Or, you know, I mean, how did people think of him at that time? Because he wasn't Lincoln in capital letters at that point.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. he's a freshman congressman. And when he gets to Washington, Henry Clay is more in line with his political views, but he decides early on in 1846, even 2 years before the election, looking ahead to it, that he thinks Zachary Taylor is the best man for the job.
Let me interrupt you. Who is Henry Clay?
Henry Clay was a Kentucky senator, okay, one of the foremost lights of the Senate, fellow Whig Party member. And this is the party that they're all in at this time in the 1840s, is the Whig Party. And he thinks that Taylor is the guy for the job because he can win. So it's a purely political calculation, very pragmatic. He's one of a handful of congressmen that includes Alexander Hamilton Stevens, who actually becomes the vice president of the Confederacy. And if you see the Lincoln movie, they're actually face-to-face at the negotiation table at the end of the movie talking about potential peace deal. So he joins with other congressmen to try to push Taylor as the candidate. So he's a very early backer, and it's for that reason that in 1848, when the Whigs in Massachusetts start to have these concerns about Taylor and they're thinking about backing a third-party candidate that year, that Lincoln's the guy that they send up from Washington to speak to his fellow party members and the voters in Massachusetts to try to get them to stick with Taylor as the nominee.
So let's parse out some things, because if I'm listening to this for the first time, and many people are, and in fact, your piece was, you know, eye-opening on a number of points, I'm thinking, Boston, Massachusetts, this is the seat of abolitionism. Mm-hmm. This is the place where folks who dared not say there should not be slavery and folks ought to be free in other parts of the country were saying it all over the place here. That's the prevailing attitude as we think of Boston at that time. And yet the candidate that the Whig Party thinks has the best chance of winning in Boston is a guy who says slavery is the natural state of being?
Well, they're not necessarily thinking about Boston. They're thinking of who's going to win the presidential election. So they're thinking on a national level, who's the candidate that's going to appeal? And I guess you can sort of compare, you know, Boston today as to Boston in 1848, and the politics aren't necessarily what fits the rest of the country. So when you're choosing a nominee, you're not necessarily thinking about who's going to carry Boston that much. But those abolitionists feelings that are there and that you talk about are what concerns the party bosses back in Washington, because this third party develops called the Free Soilers, and they put up for as their nominee Martin Van Buren, a former president of the United States, and a lot of the people in Massachusetts are thinking about backing this third party candidate for that precisely that reason, because he's not the slaveholding war hero that is against their ideals. And I think that gets back to this whole thing when you think about Lincoln, or you know, there's always these conflicts between the political and pragmatic versus the idealistic. And I think, you know, the journey of Lincoln's life, you sort of see these evolution of him as a politician, and he moves further and further from the pragmatic to the ideologue. But I think a lot of that is, you know, he's pushed in that direction too. And Boston's where you find a lot of those ideologues that sort of push him along on that journey.
So he comes to Boston to help boost up the campaign of Zachary Taylor, who is known to be in support of slavery. It was a 13-day trip, as you say in your piece. And what did he do while he was here in that 13-day trip?
Well, his primary goal is he was going to speak to some of the candidates at the state party convention out in Worcester. So that's his first stop when he arrives here. And he makes a pretty decent impression on the candidates there, and he starts getting other speaking requests from different party organizations in different towns. So he spends a couple of nights in Worcester, and he bounces around to other towns and cities in the area, New Bedford and Lowell, and finally comes to Boston and sort of bases himself there and does trips to Dedham and Taunton and Chelsea and Dorchester. And basically that's what he's doing. He's going around speaking to the party members, trying to get them not to break ranks and trying to convince them to stay within the party and support the party's nominee for president. So it's a lot of Lincoln on the stump, giving sort of a standard stump speech where, you know, you would find very much in a modern sense of politics. He's out there, first of all, telling you that you don't want to vote for the third party candidate, because you vote for the third party candidate, you're going to help the guy you don't want to win. You're wasting your vote.
We've heard that.
So it's a
yeah.
very, very modern political argument that he's making. And then he takes on a second role that you would see in modern politics as well, as the surrogate. And he's going after the opposition candidate. So he's going around town basically trying to tear down Van Buren. And in that sense, he's more speaking against the opposition than necessarily for his own candidate here.
I'm speaking with Chris Klein, history buff and writer. He's written a piece for the Boston Globe called How Boston Changed Lincoln. And we're talking about the 13-day trip that Abraham Lincoln made to Massachusetts in 1848 in support of the slave-holding candidate, or the guy who was in favor of keeping slavery intact. Some may be a little bit puzzled by that, but that was Lincoln then. So the title of your piece, Chris Klein, is How Boston Changed Lincoln. So here he is doing the stump speech, saying don't waste your vote on Martin Van Buren, who was not in favor of slavery, saying stick with us, understanding as a young freshman congressman that this is a practical, a pragmatic and political move on his part. And yet, while he's here, what happens?
Two things happen. One is this is his first foray into the abolitionist stronghold, the anti-slavery stronghold in Boston. So he really gets firsthand appreciation for just how deep these feelings run here in Boston and among the his party members up here in the North. So that's something that getting that firsthand knowledge and talking to the people who had those views is something that really begins to open his eyes. The second event that really happens is on his last night in Boston, he gives a speech at the Tremont Temple, and he's not the headliner that evening. The headliner that evening is William Seward, who is becomes eventually his Secretary of State and his War Cabinet, sort of his right-hand man. If you see the movie Lincoln, you know, Seward's a very prominent character in that.
But at this point, he doesn't know Seward?
At this point, it's the first time he ever meets Seward.
Okay.
In fact, they wouldn't meet again until 12 years later, the last days of the 1860 campaign. But his meeting with Seward has such an impression on him that even 12 years later, he can remember specifically what they talked about. But Seward gives this big speech about slavery, and you know, Lincoln's giving his standard stump speech again, don't vote for the third party, don't waste your vote. And the speech really affects Lincoln, because a couple days after that, he's talking to Seward and he says that, you know, I think you're right. We're going to have to do some more on this slavery issue. We can't ignore it. It's something that's going to require more action. And I think, you know, it's that interaction with Seward that starts to get him to move maybe past a little bit past the pragmatism and sort of dip his toe into the slavery issue. He returns to Washington, and maybe because of meeting Seward, he does something he hadn't done before, really getting into the slavery issue. So he begins to draft a bill that would abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. Now, it has these provisions in it that would compensate slaveholders. It would honor the fugitive slaves would be returned to their owners. It's something that is considered, again, by the ideologues in Boston, far too much of a compromise, not something that really has the moral high ground. And it's something that's quickly scuttled. But it's sort of the first time you see Lincoln on the national scene, you know, sort of putting pen to paper in terms of actual legislation on the slavery issue.
A couple of questions. What is it do you think that Seward said at that first impactful meeting or observation by Lincoln that really made him think about it? Was it in that moment that he thought about what slavery actually meant, the owning of other people, or was it something else?
No, I don't think so, because I think, you know, through his life, Lincoln always thought that slavery was an evil institution. It's a question of how you're going to deal with it. And at this point, you know, Lincoln's still in favor of, just slavery where it exists. You know, that's pretty much what the reality is. We have to work to prevent the further spread of it. But it was more that Seward actually talked about slavery. And the other speakers that night at Tremont Temple were giving more political speeches. And Seward's out there talking more about the institution of slavery and talking about it more on a moral ground that, you know, would strike the audience of the time in Boston, too, talking about this as, that it was Seward's belief that slavery within their lifetime would end. And that's something that stays with Lincoln because 12 years later, you know, he tells Seward, you know, I remember that you said that and that there was going to be a change in the country and in the institution of slavery. And, you know, by that point, a lot had changed in those ensuing 12 years as well. Seward actually, in 1860, when it's time to nominate for the Republican Party, Lincoln and Seward are sort of the primary candidates. Massachusetts backed Seward. So much so that when Lincoln comes back, he comes back to Boston one more time in 1860. And Seward has such support here that Lincoln was on his way to visit his son Robert up at Exeter Academy, chose not to give any political speeches here, went right through town to go up to New Hampshire where he continued his speech making up there, but not here in Boston.
Twists of so many twists and turns there. One other point. In returning to Washington after being influenced by Seward after the first trip, the 1848 trip, and now putting together this legislation that, even though it may be viewed as a compromise by the true abolitionists here in Boston, wouldn't that be considered a huge flip-flop? I mean, the guy just came off of 13 days of saying this guy, this guy, this guy, and then he gets to Washington and says, well, maybe not so much.
Yeah, you know, there's always these contradictions that you sort of see in there. And even when he's campaigning for Taylor, the slaveholder, he's making the point that you don't necessarily have to vote for Taylor, the person. And Taylor being the slaveholder isn't necessarily, he says he's not in favor of the expansion of slavery. And you should believe Taylor in that regards. So, you know, it's one of these things where he's always caught between the idealism, his ideals, the moral ideals, and what's possible. And I think you see that a lot, you know, when we talk about President Obama, too. You know, when do you compromise? When do you stick to your ideals? And I think you see that in discussion of a lot of presidents in politics. You know, when are you a sellout? Or when are you trying to get something done? And I think Lincoln decided that this isn't necessarily me selling out. I'm going to try to get something done while I'm here.
So what was the response to his change of heart, change of perspective, however you want to look at it, when he came back with the compromise bill?
Yeah, well, he basically gets attacked on both sides.
There you go.
So you have people like Wendell Phillips, the Boston abolitionist, who basically savage it because of this whole provisions to give compensation to slave owners and to return fugitive slaves. He basically calls Lincoln the slave hound from Illinois, and he'll keep calling him that for about the next decade. Slavery supporters in the South, not in favor of it. They don't want, you know, to get rid of slavery in the district. That would just be another place where the institution's being chipped away at. So basically, the bill does not become introduced to the floor. It's basically a non-starter. And these are sort of in the lame duck days of his one term in Congress anyway. So the bill does not get much traction after Lincoln tries to put it together.
So Chris Klein, and we're talking to Chris Klein, whose piece, How Boston Changed Lincoln, that would be Abraham Lincoln. Chris revisits a 13-day trip in 1848 that Abraham Lincoln made to Boston and was influenced forevermore about his view on slavery. In fact, it appears that after his trip here and his meeting with Seward, who became an important part of his political life later on, that he went back to Washington with some ideas about how to move away from slavery as a function of any function in America. So I'm curious, Chris Klein, how you came to know about Lincoln and his Boston trips.
Well, it's just one of those little lines that you see somewhere when you're reading, and you see a mention of Lincoln being here in 1848. So, you know, sort of piqued my interest a little bit on it and sort of, you know, start doing some more research on it. And, you know, it becomes interesting to sort of see how that trip at that time of his political life sort of fits in there and those connections that he makes here. So, you know, it's one of those things. I think a lot of great history, you sort of see something, you're like, oh, I never knew that. And then the more you dig, the more you find that how interesting it is.
Why do you think that Abraham Lincoln continues to fascinate not just folk, like, you know, we readers and interested in history, but historians themselves? I mean, I don't know that a lot of people know there are about 200 historians whose entire lives are dedicated to poring over the details of Abraham Lincoln's life and policies. I mean, it's amazing. It's also amazing that those 200 couldn't put together the book that Doris Kearns Goodwin did, and which everybody should know about, which is called Team of Rivals. And she pulled together the connections of in Lincoln's life, looking at how he, in fact, embraced people who had been rivals politically with him and brought them into his government and into governance when he was president, because he thought they would offer something to the country larger than just their disagreements ideologically. And it worked very well for him. But, you know, so we got all this interest in Lincoln by these historians focused on him. But what about the rest of us? Why is he continuing to be fascinated? It's kind of like the Marilyn Monroe of history.
Yeah. you know, I think, first of all, it's just his place in American history. So he's just such a towering figure that, you know, he's not of the era of the founding fathers, but in a sense, you know, he's sort of in there with Lincoln and Jefferson, Washington and Jefferson. So I think, you know, you just have to start with that. But I think what makes him such a fascinating figure is Lincoln the man and this struggle that was inside him, I think. And you take a look at
You define the struggle as what? Just how to be a pragmatic politician and also have some nod to morality? What do you define the struggle as?
Yeah, I think it's your struggle between your pragmatic political side and your idealistic side. And I think if you see the movie, this is sort of a central tenet in it, because you sort of see Lincoln at the center, and he's getting pulled at the edges by the radical Republicans, who have very much been moralizing on the slavery issue, and they don't want to do any sort of compromise on the issue, because this is a strictly moral issue. It's not anything that we're going to compromise on. But then, you know, when does it come a point when you stick to your ideals and then you don't make any progress to what those goals are? And I think Lincoln, you see that conflict is just bound up inside Lincoln, and he has this evolution just in his political life where you see him making this move even into the course of his presidency too. You know, again, we think of, Lincoln the Great Emancipator, but that didn't necessarily mean that he believed necessarily in the equality of races, or he thought that, all African Americans should even stay in America. Early in his presidency, he's thinking maybe the best solution to the slavery issue is to start a colony in Central America, where you just take all the African American slaves and you just send them to Central America, and that way the problem is solved. So,
we heard self deportation before.
Exactly. So
with a different group of people.
Exactly. So it's really this internal struggle, and then Lincoln the Man too is sort of at these cross purposes where you see, in the movie too, you see him telling these very humorous stories to the point where his cabinet is constantly rolling their eyes because here goes Lincoln telling another story. The humor inside the man versus this, the melancholy that you will see inside Lincoln sometimes as well. The brooding Lincoln, inside the walls of the White House as well. So he's a fascinating man and a fascinating figure, and you combine that with one of the seminal moments in American history, and I think that's why he still captures the public imagination.
So obviously you saw the movie by Steven Spielberg named Lincoln, which was based on, in some large part, the book by Doris Kearns Goodwin, who, if folks don't know, lives right here in Cambridge, and her book being Team of Rivals. Did you think it was pretty on target?
It was fantastic. I mean, I must say, it was actually kind of heartening to a history geek like me to see that there was a line out the door for the movie, but if you wanted to go see Twilight, you could have walked right in and had any seat in the house. So that was pretty nice to see. And it's probably the first movie since Rocky III, I think, I've had to sit in the front row to see, but it was definitely worth the neck strain. It was amazing to me. We've never heard Lincoln's voice. We've never seen him in a moving image, yet you see him on the screen and you can't help but thinking, like, yeah, they got that pretty right somehow. it's just
felt right.
It felt right. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And even some of the secondary characters, the way that they were able to get them even visually through makeup to look the same as some of these figures, that leap right off the black and white pages in the books, it was truly amazing. And then, the story and story plot, the storyline was done fantastic also.
And that's by big history buff Chris Klein, who wrote the piece, How Boston Changed Lincoln. So from real R-E-E-L history to R-E-A-L history, I note in your piece something that I did not know, that when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, Boston again played a part in this.
Yes, the pen that Lincoln uses to sign the Emancipation Proclamation is given to a Cambridge abolitionist by the name of George Livermore, sort of as Lincoln's nod to the role that Boston abolitionists played to get to that moment in history. So he gives the pen to George Livermore, and now it's in the possession of the Massachusetts Historical Society.
I'm sure I certainly did not know that. I think I want to go look at it now. That's pretty interesting. Who knew that Boston had such an impression on a young congressman named Lincoln? Can we then, we've mentioned a couple of times some of the parallels, because we've heard anyway that President Obama looked to Lincoln even as much as standing on the same steps that he stood on when he delivered the Gettysburg Address when he ran the first time in 2008 to make his announcement that he was going to run for president. So he looks to Lincoln then as a model in some way, we suppose, because we've heard that. And you've mentioned some of the linkages here. Do you see him modeling, in fact, some of the Lincoln-esque kind of approaches?
Well, I think in one sense, very early on, and I believe after he's elected, I think they asked him about his reading list, and one of the books he was reading was Team of Rivals. And
well, wasn't Chris?
Well,
I mean,
guess
really?
So, right, but,
go ahead.
I don't have enough time to read all
it's
that stuff.
Excellent. You need to put that on your
absolutely. Whether he's influenced by that or not, of course, when he goes to fill his vacancy for Secretary of State, much like Lincoln, he goes to fill it with his rival for his party's nomination. So right there is a very direct parallel, and whether he was thinking about Lincoln when he did that or not, perhaps that was one connection. But I think in some respects it's tough to make parallels like that, but I do think it is funny when you sort of see these conflicts at play in Lincoln, and obviously Obama's not dealing with nearly the same level of moral issues that that Lincoln is. But the criticism that Lincoln took from different sides when, he thought it was time to compromise to get things done, and the same that Obama is, or the criticism he faces when he's not getting things done because he isn't compromising on an issue, I think you see that same ideologue versus pragmatic politician.
You see the evolution, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
All right. We've been talking with Chris Klein, who will be picking up a copy of Team of Rivals. He's seen the movie. and he wrote the fantastic piece, How Boston Changed Lincoln, about Abraham Lincoln's visit to Boston and how it impacted his vision about politics and slavery. Thank you so much, Chris Klein.
Thanks, Kelly. It's great.
Emily Rooney's back in Studio 3.
All right, Callie, so everybody knows what the gold rush is. You know what the green rush is?
I happen to know what the green rush is.
All right, well, for those of you who don't, it is the rush to cash in on the legalization of medical marijuana. Our financial expert, Cheryl Marshall, is going to explain how you can invest in it.
I think it's going to be a boon for cash-strapped states, too.
I think so. It's a boondoggle, too.
All right. I'm Callie Crossley.
I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio.